Hello, this is Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. In this episode, and in the next, we're exploring the innovation journey from intent to implementation. This podcast is recorded on Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present, and future, and indeed to the elders of the lands on which you're listening today. There are three big ideas at the centre of Finzi and at the centre of Taxi's practice. Systems, innovation, and participation. And this is how I see that they all fit together. Systemic thinking gives you a really good way to get started, to frame a problem, to identify high leverage points in existing systems, and to orientate your response to that system. Whereas innovation gives you the mindsets and the processes to try things out, to act in that system, to develop new knowledge about what works, and to scale knowledge about what works. And participation? Well, that helps you think about who to take on the journey and practical tools to shift the power dynamics about who makes decisions about what. But that's the next episode. In this episode, we're going to be focusing in on innovation. And this episode is a tale of two social innovations, both of them supporting children and families. Over the next two episodes, we're going to travel their journey from their beginnings as an intent through their discovery processes, idea generation processes, and ultimately onto spread and scale. One story is the story of a whole family of innovations developed by Taxi over the years, centred around a programme called Family by Family. And it's a story that starts in 2010 in Oaklands Park in a suburb of Adelaide and travels to New South Wales, other places in Adelaide, and ultimately to the UK, reaching over 2,000 families and counting. The other story is focused on childhood nutrition and starts a little earlier in 1990 in some villages 4 hours drive south of Hanoi in Vietnam. And it's an innovation that ends up creating its own university and spreading to reach over 250 villages in 22 provinces in Vietnam with a total population of 23 million. And the metaphor that we're using in these stories of innovation is one of a journey. A journey that's going to start in the forest of intent before crossing into the mysterious and foggy valley of discovery. Then we'll start to scale the slopes of invention before coming down the other side, down the slopes of implementation and into the beautiful valley of outcomes. Part 1. The Forest of Intent. The travellers sat in a clearing in the forest, the one place where the light pierced the dense canopy of trees above, and the place where the pathways converged. One pathway, the story said, led to the headland with some decent fishing. The other, to an abundant pasture of unrivaled plenty. After many nights of debate, it's on that pasture that they set their sights, even though the story said that to get there, they would first have to cross a dangerous mountain range.
Myself and my children were fleeing family and domestic violence. We had lost all of our connections. I was stripped of my natural instincts and I needed support.
Family stress can present in a breakdown of communication, the blinds being drawn down in the house, the television being turned up, and that can really isolate the family away from things that are going to be good for them.
Through the journey of single parenting, there were times where I didn't know where to turn. And when I did, doors would slam. And that tough journey has given me the skills, the understanding, and the empathy to be able to help others.
We now see across most of Australia instances of child abuse in one in four children, that poverty is on the rise, suicide rates are at an all-time high, and our services just can't keep up. We need new ways to support from the bottom up. And one of Australia's greatest assets that it could really leverage are families themselves.
Family by Family is a network of families helping other families make change. If you can normalise the fact that every family has their ups and downs and that each of us can ask for help when we need it, it starts to make a shift in the way we accept help and how we offer it.
The program was developed by families. It utilises families to support families and puts resources into those communities through the families.
I never thought I would help someone get their child back. I never thought I'd help people get through custody battles. I was a child in a custody battle between my parents.
We're different from a professional or a social worker because my lived experience allows me to connect with a family on a different level. The boundaries get dropped.
Family by Family allowed me to have an understanding that I was worth more than how I was feeling as a mother and as an individual person.
It's a whole family affair. No one's left out, from myself to my partner to my children. It is honestly the best thing.
That's Family by Family. And today you can be a part of it if you're in a family in Adelaide in South Australia, or if you're in Stoke-on-Trent in the UK. But in this episode, I wanted to go back in time to 2010 when the project was just getting started and before we even had the idea of families helping families. Back in 2010, Family by Family, or as it was called then, the Family Project, or before that, the Radical Redesign Project, was the first project I worked on at TACSI. As a new organisation, we really wanted to build the credibility of a design-based approach to public problem solving. And so we asked around in South Australia to get people to name an intractable problem that we could demonstrate our new design-based social innovation approach on. We wanted to show that if you involve the people most affected by the problem in solving it, you're more likely to get a better result. The question that we came to was, how can we enable more families to thrive and fewer to come into contact with state-provided child protection services? This is a bigger problem than you might think in Australia. Around one in four children have contact with child protection services before the age of 15. Typically, as I'd come to learn, because at that point I knew nothing about child protection services are provided on a case manager-based model. Support comes from a professional, and they really struggle to keep up with demand. The result is that by the time you get a service, things just get so bad that it could be too late, and you get a service you don't want, the one that gets your child removed from your care. And we wanted to come up with an alternative. This is Brenton Caffin, CEO of TACSI at the time.
Talking to stakeholders from across government, not-for-profit and the community sector, this was clearly an area of need. The child protection system is, it's fair to say, in a state of crisis, and not just here in South Australia, but across Australia, and it was felt that if we could make a difference in this space, it would be most appreciated.
We wanted to show that if you started by really listening to what people wanted and needed, then you'd end up with a different set of services and policies. As our intent was to demonstrate a new methodology and solution, using our own seed funding, we had the luxury that we didn't have to design to fit into an existing funding envelope or service specification. We wanted to create a breakthrough solution, something that would demonstrate what was possible if you took this different approach. We asked around to try and identify a problem that people cared about, one that people had failed to develop a response to before, one where a new approach could make a real difference, and child protection was the answer. And through that process, exploring our intent, which included testing some alternatives around a focus on carers or a focus on young people, we landed on a focus on families. We set ourselves the question, how can we enable more families to thrive and fewer to come into contact with child protection services? It's an early example of what we came to call the double outcome question. A question that's got an outcome that people care about, thriving in this case, and an outcome that funders care about, often in the form of numbers. For example, reduced cost to government through reduced usage of government services in this case. So this stage wasn't so much a design decision, but more of a question of strategy. We were a new team with something to prove and funding to do that. But often, intent is much more constrained. Our second story starts 20 years earlier, in Vietnam. And it's a story of how Jerry and Monique Sternin, when working for Save the Children, worked with villagers living in rural villages to make a significant impact on malnutrition amongst children. I'm going to be reading from the book by Jerry Sterning and Monica Sterning, together with Ricardo Pascal, called The Power of Positive Deviance. And this is the story as told by Jerry Sternin himself. In 1990, the US NGO Save the Children received an unprecedented invitation from the government of Vietnam to create a program that would enable poor villages to solve the all-pervasive problem of childhood malnutrition. Ironically, the invitation was extended during the period of the US government's trade embargo against Vietnam, which sought to enforce the Paris Peace Accords through economic sanctions. Save the Children asked me if I would leave my post as director of their Philippines program and go to Vietnam to open the program there. Although, or because the challenge was so formidable, I eagerly accepted. And in December 1990, Monique and our son Sam, who had just turned 10, and I left for Hanoi to become the 13th, 14th, and 15th Americans to take up residence in that city. I was summoned to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs the week after our arrival. Mr. Nguyen, a high-ranking official, greeted me in his Spartan Hospital Green office and offered me a folding chair next to his desk. He was eager for me to know that he was personally very supportive of Save the Children and had been instrumental in inviting us to come to Vietnam. After a few perfunctory pleasantries, he got straight to the point. Sternin, there are many officials who don't want you in this country, he warned. You have 6 months to demonstrate impact. I'm afraid my ministry will be unable to extend your visas. 6 months. An adrenaline rush. I was stunned by the enormity of the challenge, and only minimally reassured by my conviction that great opportunities are often accompanied by great risks. But there it was, a very real danger of failure, given only 6 months to show impact. Juxtaposed on to this was the extraordinary opportunity if we could somehow succeed. Some issues were clear. The government of Vietnam simply didn't have the resources to address the problem of ongoing malnutrition in 10,000 rural villages. A strategy had to be identified to enable the villages to somehow solve the problem themselves. The focus clearly had to be preventative as well as curative. Given our 6-month deadline and my conviction that any solution must be sustainable, I knew this couldn't be business as usual. We'd have to find a new approach based on something that was already working, using resources already available. These defining criteria all pointed towards an obscure research construct, positive deviance. Part 2, The Mysterious Valley of Discovery. As they approached the foothills, the peaks disappeared, cloaked by a deep fog. The more they advanced towards the direction of the summit, the foggier it got. They struggled to find footholds in the confusion. They lost their track. But with perseverance, it started to make some kind of sense. They rose higher and the fog started to clear. Or had it? It was hard to tell.
We've been trying to answer who is this for? Who are the right families? What are the right cohort of families? We've been trying to understand what are the right activities that happen in a connection to actually see change occur. How does change happen? How can we design tools that enable change? What are the right rhythms and flows for a professional to come in and out of a connection? How do we hold risk?
This is Daniel Abbott talking about the discovery phase of the Virtual Village, an entirely virtual support program for people experiencing domestic violence that was based on and built from the DNA of Family by Family.
Is the digital way the right way? Who are the right? At what point do we ask a referrer to step in? We've asked so many questions. Sorry, it's 12 weeks of questions, and so like, and at the end of every kind of we operated in 2 week sprints. So at the end of every 2 week sprint, we looked back on the questions we'd asked in that 2 weeks, and we asked ourselves, have we answered these questions? Do we have a good idea of a way forward here? Was it the wrong question? Do we have new questions that have arisen across this time? And we were iterating in those 2 weeks sprints across the 12-week prototype.
Mysteries in the discovery stage come in all shapes and sizes. They may be on the smaller side of things. There may be improvement mysteries, which are about making or finding ways to do something you're already doing a bit better. They may be about adapting an existing service for a new context in the way that the Virtual Village was adapting Family by Family for a very different cohort. They may be about developing a new service, a new kind of volunteering, or a new peer-to-peer service for families like Family by Family. They might be really big mysteries, like how to tackle malnutrition in rural villages in Vietnam when that's been something people have failed at doing for decades. Or they may be mysteries that people have never solved before, like getting to the moon and back again. When it came to the discovery work with Family by Family, we had an awful lot of questions too. Questions families were best placed to answer, about family life, about their experience of existing services, and what they saw as helpful help. And questions that were best answered by practitioners in the research. How to create change for families and leading examples of practice from around the world. We looked at the research and we spoke to practitioners, but what we really wanted to understand was what family life was like for families in risk of coming into contact with child protection services. What did they aspire to and what did they consider helpful help? We ran a family festival to get to know the families living in a particular street in Oakland Park. We recruited a number of young person researchers to conduct research with their own families. We spent time hanging out with families, doing what they did. You could call this rapid ethnography, but we called it rigorous hanging out. And we offered free takeout to whole families if they'd play some learning games with us over dinner in their homes. And I ate an awful lot of butter chicken that month. I remember one evening sitting with a family in their home, which was actually a new home they'd moved to escape domestic violence. Looked at through one lens, the mum, we'll call her Tracy, was someone you'd expect to need help, a victim of domestic violence. But what we saw that evening over a cold beer was the procession of women and children coming through the house, getting practical advice and support from Tracy, all drawn from her own lived experience. I spent time with an Aboriginal family in Port Augusta who went out of their way on a weekend to bring together families living nearby with a minibus and go out bush to eat kangaroo tails and chat and provide informal support. to help those families through the challenges they were experiencing. From what we saw and what families told us, we learned that helpful help came from someone who spoke your language. It came from somebody who has been through the same things that you'd been through, and it was available outside of office hours. Helpful help more likely came from another family over and above a professional's. And with this insight, we started thinking about a family's helping family service. We're now going to rejoin the Sternins in late January 1991. They were given 6 months on their visas in Vietnam, and now they've got just 20 weeks left. We join them in the Quang Chong district in Than Hoi province, a 4-hour ride south of Hanoi, in what they called their inquiry stage. They're working with villagers to try and identify some of the strategies that led certain children in the village to be adequately nourished, whilst most were not. The self-selected health volunteers were eager to get started. Assisted by local health staff and village leaders, they then began by weighing the children and charting their nutritional status by placing dots on a simple card with two axes, one for age and the other for weight. This was the first universal weighing of all children under 3 in these communities. Consistent with the pattern of the earlier sample survey, 64% of the children suffered from some degree of malnutrition. Because we sought solutions to the problem of malnutrition that would be accessible to everyone in the community, particularly to the most vulnerable, we asked the volunteers to do a socioeconomic ranking of all households in their hamlet. With no preset categories, the volunteers chose poor, very poor, and very, very poor as accurate descriptors of the economic status of almost all village families. When they completed their rankings, we gathered the volunteers beneath the corrugated tin roof of the commune's town hall. As expected, 2/3 of the children were malnourished. The common explanation of the cause of malnutrition was poverty. We asked the volunteers if any of the well-nourished children came from very, very poor families. They looked at the tally. Several literally rose in excitement. Yes, yes, there are some children from very, very poor families who are well-nourished. Do you mean, we asked, that it's possible today for a very, very poor child in this village to be well-nourished? Ko, came the reply. It is, it is. The epiphany on that defining day in February represents an indelible milestone in a career devoted to community change. It was clear that the discovery of a possible way forward by those who needed to believe that one already existed quite literally triggered an attitudinal somersault. The aha moment broke the fundamental assumption of the experts and residents alike that villages are poor and have no solutions. Allowing the villagers to discover there were exceptions amongst them created the context for investigating what was going on. Having established the possibility of being well nourished despite extreme poverty, the volunteers explored the implications of the discovery. If some very poor families in the village had well nourished children, it might be possible for their poor neighbours to have well nourished children as well. This realisation set the stage for what would become the inquiry phase of the approach. A process that identifies how some members of a community, faced with the same constraints as their neighbours, with access to no special resources, are uniquely able to avoid or overcome a pervasive problem. Over the next week, the trained volunteers conducted many focus group discussions in each of the villages, meeting informally with mothers, grandmothers, fathers, older siblings, and community health providers. They discussed conventional practices regarding feeding, caring, and sanitation.
At this point, the village volunteers focused in on finding out about the strategies used by the very, very poor families who had well-nourished children. They call them the positive deviants.
After visiting the positive deviants' homes, we reassembled at the community meeting hall. There was a palpable buzz in the air. Each team had discovered several uncommon behaviours. First and foremost, in every instance where a poor family had a well-nourished child, the mother or father was collecting tiny shrimps or crabs, the size of one joint of one finger, from the rice paddies, and adding these to the child's diet, along with the greens from sweet potato tops.
Although readily available and free for the taking, conventional wisdom held these foods to be inappropriate or even dangerous for young children. Along with the dietary addition of shrimps, crabs, and greens, and the atypical strict hand hygiene in 5 of the 6 households, other positive deviant practices emerged. These involved frequency and method of feeding, quality of care, and sanitation. For example, most families fed their young children only twice a day, before parents headed to the rice fields early in the morning and in the late afternoon after their return. Because children under 3 years of age have small stomachs, the youngest children could eat only a small percentage of the available rice at each sitting. Positive deviant families, however, instructed the caregiver, an older sibling, a grandparent, or a neighbour, to feed these children regularly. The kids were fed 4 or even 5 times a day. Result: using exactly the same amount of rice spread out over an additional 2 or 3 meals, the PD kids were getting twice the calories as their neighbours, who had access to exactly the same resources. Through the PD inquiries, community members had discovered for themselves what it took for a very poor family to have a well-nourished child. The challenge now was to get people to translate that knowledge into practice.
To find your way through the mysterious valley of discovery, you need a plan and a methodology. One of the most effective tips is to have really good questions. You hear Danny reel off all of the questions they were answering in those 12 weeks developing the virtual village. And you heard the questions we tried to answer for family by family, and the questions the Sternins answered together with villagers. In all of those approaches to discovery, insights from people's lived experience were critical. In the case of Taxi, that was through a human-centred design methodology. In the case of the Sternins' work, it was what would come to be called the positive deviance methodology. Both these projects drew on existing evidence, research, and the practice wisdom of people in the field. But it's the lived experience, the insight from lived experience, that gave them the breakthrough hunches. The challenge with research evidence is that it's by definition from the past and nearly always from another context. And if you're doing innovation, you're always looking for a solution that will work in your context tomorrow. Part 3. Invention. As our travellers climbed out of the mysterious fog, they were immediately faced with another challenge. A deep and deadly ravine lay ahead of them, blocking their path. No bridge in sight. How could they cross it? They camped for the night, to wait for inspiration to hit, and the calling to come.
Great discovery phase will give you great insight into the existing situation. It will tell you what the existing evidence is. You'll learn what practitioners on the ground think might work. But a great discovery stage is not going to do your innovation for you. You still need to make some kind of creative leap to move towards the thing that is going to work. And that requires ideas and inspiration and imagination alongside everything you've done in discovery. And who better to ask about where ideas come from than a small child? I asked my son, Frank.
Almost everyone knows where ideas come from. Up here.
What, up there?
The brain.
The brain. But do they come from the brain alone, or is there other things that you have to put in your brain to get new ideas out?
You sort of have to look at stuff first and then get ideas.
Ah, so you've got to put things in there?
So you basically just have to, or you can just think about stuff and turn it into something else.
So I think Frank's got it about half right. To have ideas, you've got to put some sort of stimulation in your brain, and you can then recombine those to make new ideas. Certainly with Family by Family, that was a combination of strategies we'd seen families use in their own homes and with their neighbours, along with ideas taken from other innovations like Mother to Mother, and something called the Family Independence Initiative in Oakland, California.
But the other half of the story, the bit Frank didn't get, is about how you create the conditions for those ideas to come together. My favourite perspective on this comes from John Cleese, the comic mind behind Monty Python's Flying Circus. And he says that all creativity is in effect an act of the subconscious. And to bring that forth, you've got to create time and space to have these ideas. And it's unlikely to happen if your phone's ringing and if you're checking email.
Because to sum up something I sometimes take 3 hours to say, all creativity comes from the unconscious. If creativity came from logic and intelligence, then all the logical, intelligent people could do it. But they can't. It all boils down to getting in a playful and relaxed frame of mind. Most of it's to do with relaxation, because unless you're relaxed, you can't hear the promptings from the unconscious. You know, nobody ever had a bright idea when they were attacking a machine gun nest. You see what I mean? If you're occupied with activity, and that's one of the reasons why there's so little creativity at the moment, is that nobody gets any peace anymore. Because these damn things are ringing all the time and beep there, and you know, you sit down, there's another email come in. It's absolutely poisonous, because interruptions and anxiety will kill any kind of creativity, so you have to.
In their book, the Sternings describe the creative leap that happened in their project. The space was created by a really long drive from the village to Hanoi, which was further delayed by a broken down train. And they reflected on what one of the villagers had said to them. 1,000 hearings aren't worth one seeing, and 1,000 seeings aren't worth one doing. This had caused them to reflect on their work and how the next step in this sort of development work was often to teach villagers the effective strategies. But they realised they needed to do more than that. What we needed to do was create an opportunity for people to practice rather than merely know about the successful PD behaviours the villagers had just discovered. And if this is all sounding a little unscientific, here's Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize-winning physicist, talking about how guesses are the very foundation of science.
Now I'm going to discuss how we would look for a new law. In general, we look for a new law by the following process. First, we guess it. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see what, if this is right, if this law that we guessed is right, we see what it would imply. And then we compare those computation results to nature, or we say compare to experiment or experience, compare it directly with observation to see if it works. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. In that simple statement is the key to science. It doesn't make any difference how beautiful your guess is. It doesn't make any difference how smart you are who made the guess or what his name is. If it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. That's all there is to it. It's therefore not unscientific to take a guess, although many people who are not in science think it is.
Having crossed the ravine and survived, the travelers now had to improvise their way to the peak. There was no map for where they were going, just trial and error. When it comes to social innovation, the practical form experimentation takes is usually something like prototyping. You start with a hunch, or a guess, or a hypothesis. Then you build a version of that hunch and you test it out in the real world in order to get feedback on that. And then based on that feedback, you refine the idea, or you reject the idea, or you take it in a new direction completely. And this is something that's really familiar to us all. And so once again, I turn to a child to explain it.
Oh, well, what does that mean that something's a prototype? Because I don't think everybody knows what a prototype is.
What do you mean?
Well, how would you explain what a prototype is to your sent to someone?
I would probably explain, like, the first version of something that you think might not work, but it could work.
And why would you build a prototype? Why wouldn't you just build something that works from the start?
You would build a prototype so that you knew, well, sort of what to do.
Yeah, right. So it helps you work out your ideas?
Sort of.
Why not build something that's perfect from the start?
Because if you build a prototype, you will know what to add in or what to take away.
When it came to prototyping family by family, first, we tried out ideas on paper, getting feedback from families on the experience of the program that we were dreaming up. What would happen first? What would happen next? How long would it last? How would you choose the family that helped you? A lot of questions. Then, when we had the basics in place, we built a small version of the service and ran it for 20 weeks, with 20 families taking part. We called it prototyping, an intentional and somewhat fancy process of trial and error that enables you to more rapidly develop solutions, be they services or policy. We learned so much from this prototype experience. For example, I spent hours outside of supermarkets trying to recruit families into the prototype program. Families refused to stop, so we kept changing our messaging and working on different activities that could catch a family's and children's interests. One day, we could change the message 5 times until we found one that worked. Then, once we'd recruited families to help other families, we needed to train them. Our first training lasted 3 days. It was really expensive, and everyone left confused. The second training we ran a few weeks later was so much clearer. Now, after further refinement, the training lasts for a single day. We assumed that the training would need to focus on helping families build relationships with other families, but we were wrong. Families were great at that, but what they did need help with was identifying what had helped them get through tough times, to identify their own strengths and strategies, and to tell those stories in a way that helps others. In this stage of prototyping, the families were playing a much bigger role. They were deciding what the program should be, what things should be called, and what was important in a professional role. Families would go on to help us design and prototype the recruitment process for professionals. Families are part of the panel for that, and professionals have to run a session for kids. And there's a part where families can ask professionals anything. A favourite, from a teenager to a prospective coach: do you have affairs? The prototyping process for the virtual village was far more rapid. In fact, Danny and her team had to simultaneously deliver a service whilst building it. And to join some dots, I first met Danny just after she'd undergone interrogation by families for a family coach role in Family by Family. If you recognise her voice, it's because you heard her talking about that programme in an excerpt from the video.
We did start with a set of questions that we were holding and some hunches. A lot of those hunches were debunked. We had a massive hunch that if we were going to be connecting to families who were on low incomes and who were regional and remote, that actually an internet service which came into their living room via Zoom or a digital platform would be really hard to do because we might have problems with connectivity. That was our first kind of hunch that was debunked. What we actually found was that most families had brilliant connection. They were already gaming, or they had, like, you know, the best Netflix stream. There were multiple devices within a family. So, you know, even if somebody didn't have a computer, their child might have an iPad or phone, and we were able to really work around most of those issues very quickly. I think we had a hunch that this wouldn't work because families would want to meet with other families in their local area. And actually that was really debunked as well, because what we discovered along the way is that families found safety in connecting to somebody who wasn't in their hometown, especially when you're living in a small rural community. Everyone knows everyone's business. And actually what provided safety for families, especially women who were experiencing domestic violence, was able to gain support from somebody who didn't know the connections in the town. Often women aren't believed, or there's a sense of shame around what they're experiencing. So they were able to connect better because somebody was zooming in from across the country to support them. And another, I guess, hunch that we had that was really challenged for us is that you couldn't create an intimate environment for personal relationship via a web platform. And actually what we've found is that people open up more in that space, and that we actually are going deeper much quicker within that world.
Whilst prototyping may make complete sense to kids, and it's really quite commonsensical that if you don't know how something works, you try it out and try it out again and try it out again, we should really remember how different this is to cultures and ways of working in lots of organisations. This, for example, is an excerpt from a video that was shot just after the prototyping phase of Family by Family. And the person talking is Carolyn Curtis, who's now our CEO at Taxi, but then she'd just joined the project, was part of the Family by Family design team, and up until that point had spent a lot of her working life working in government environments where there was a very different approach to developing new services and policies.
It has challenged me personally and professionally in every way a person could be challenged. It's right from the start, I'm assessment versus ethnography and writing a policy versus co-design and prototyping versus piloting, throwing things out as quickly as you make them. It's just really starting from the bottom up, and I really, really understand now, and I think it's taken me the full 12 months, but I do really understand the potential that exists when you design and you create something with your end user versus creating something for them that you think will fit them best.
The innovation journey is a long one, and sometimes it can feel like you're always restarting it. It took us about 6 months to get to the idea for a service that was about families helping families, and then another 6 months to run the prototype of Family by Family for 20 families and to tell the story of that. We had a model that focused on how to create change, but no one was running it, and we hadn't yet really created the model for operationalising it. To my great surprise, about a year after starting the family project, we were able to get funding to run Family by Family as a real service in South Australia. Carolyn took over as director of Family by Family and set about building a team of practitioners and families. There was still heaps to be developed to support the model, including all of the legal infrastructure for what was perceived as a very risky program, including the way to operationalise the measurement system at scale, the way sharing families would be financially rewarded for their time and wisdom, and the way new staff would be recruited and trained. And that still wasn't it. We invented and refined the change model through the design phase, and Carolyn and her team created the operational model for Taxi to run Family by Family. But we didn't have a way to spread the model more broadly so that other organisations who weren't Taxi could pick it up and run with it. That would take another 10 years. Time to go back to Vietnam and catch up again with the Sternins. And now they're taking that hunch that families needed to practice these new strategies rather than just learn them. And they spent weeks refining a model that was effective in enabling families to sustain these strategies that they'd seen in the positive deviance. we convened a meeting with the volunteers, local leaders and health clinic staff to get their input. The aim was to design a process to teach villagers the special practices that had been discovered. What we needed to do was create an opportunity for people to practice rather than merely know about successful PD behaviours the villagers had just discovered. By the end of the second week, and scores of meetings later, a design emerged. For 2 weeks every month, mothers or other caretakers would bring their malnourished children to a neighbour's house for a few hours every day. Together with the health volunteer, they prepared and fed a nutritious supplemental meal to their children. The mums or caretakers practiced cooking new recipes with the health volunteers, and also learned and applied basic sanitation and care practices. These sessions provided an opportunity to practice successful behaviours identified during the positive deviance inquiry, such as active feeding and washing the caretakers and children's hands with soap and water over the course of the meal whenever they touched an unclean object. For the caretakers, the sessions provided a legitimate productive activity, but one that also happened to be fun. The little kids loved the party atmosphere of the sessions, and often terrible eaters astonished their mums by becoming marathon eaters as they competed with 8 or 9 other happy, chewing kids. Here was cause for celebration. We were getting caretakers to bring their kids to the monthly 2-week sessions. They were being rehabilitated through the provision of additional food plus the PD practices. But we still faced the challenge of ensuring that they continue those practices at home after the session. It was the concern for the sustainability of behavioural change that led to the introduction of the mandatory daily contribution component of the nutrition sessions. Every day, each mother or caretaker was required to bring a handful of shrimps, crabs or greens as part of the price of admission to the session. For 2 weeks every month, someone in the family had to go out to the rice paddy early in the mornings and, ankle-deep in mud, collect the required shrimps or crabs. By the time the 2-week programme was over for that month, the trip to the rice paddy with a small net and empty container had become routine. One of the other great reinforcers of behavioural change is the ability for people to see results. All children were weighed on the first and last days of the 2-week nutrition session. Typically, mums and health volunteers gathered around the scale, like a crowd at a lottery scratching the numbers on their card just before the drawing. All waited for the needle to come to rest. The result? 3/4 of kids put on weight. Each weighing was greeted with applause and cheers. Seeing that new behaviour had actually resulted in their kids gaining weight and becoming naughtier, active and lively rather than apathetic and listless, caretakers returned home committing to practicing their newly acquired methods. Children who reached normal nutritional status during the first nutritional session graduated. Those who remained malnourished were signed up for the next session to be held the following month. Community monitoring of the progress of each child's nutritional status was a critical element of the overall success and sustainability of the program. Each health volunteer carried her own growth monitoring book with fold-out pages, enabling her to record and track the weight and nutritional status of each child in a hamlet over time. Weights were also captured at the village child growth monitoring sessions every 2 months. This enabled health volunteers and local leaders to review the overall trend lines for all the young children over 60 days. Scorecards captured each child's weight and were compiled into a village-wide tally. By the fourth nutritional session in early June, 5.5 months into the 6-month pilot, the process seemed to have been incorporated into the village repertoire. Everyone had either a child, a relative, or a neighbour's kid participating in the programme. Invariably, Monique, Hien, and I were warmly greeted. Things just couldn't have gone better.
So by this stage in their journey, the villagers and the Sternins had done a significant amount of invention and experimentation, and indeed they'd found a formula for villagers to adopt those strategies sustainably. The formula was something like you bring the villagers together in their neighbours' homes, they practice those strategies, and they need to find the crabs and the greens as the price of entry, so they build those behaviours over time. And creating a formula, something that works nearly every time or as close as you can get to it, that's the goal when you're developing innovations for scale. That's the goal of the slopes of invention. But the Sternins weren't there yet. They developed something that was successful and indeed was starting to attract a lot of interest, but they didn't yet have a formula for spreading it to multiple villages. That came next. And that's where we're going to leave this story. In the next episode, we'll be reconnecting with the Sternins and family by family for the other half of the innovation journey. How will the Sternins replicate the model in other village with just 10 weeks left on their visa? Will family by family find the formula for scale? What happened in the next 10 years? And what about the virtual village? And will the travellers find their new homeland? Join us next time for Foundations in Social Innovation.